on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
If you can set up an agreement together and say, okay, this is where we're going forward, and both feel good about it, you've immediately maximized your chances of actually making sure the collaboration is a success. And even if it's not, and you find out, you know, a few weeks, months down the line that it's not, you gave it your best chance, and what you might have learned is that a collaboration isn't necessarily for you.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. It's The Self-Publishing Show with James Blatch.
And Mark Dawson.
Wow, there's a pause for effect there. Mark, you sounded a little bit sluggish then, but you must be on cloud nine because you have reached not nine, but number eight, I think, in the Sunday Times yes. bestseller list in the UK, which is the equivalent of the New York Times bestseller list, or I guess roughly the equivalent. It's a very high profile list of the best-selling books, even though, as our discussion last week, isn't necessarily reflective of the books people are buying. Nonetheless, that's how it works. And what a thrill was that to see your name in lights.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So we had, as we mentioned on the podcast last week, this time, well, we're recording this on Monday before the Friday that this goes out. But end of last week, we were just trying to figure out ways to get books to non-UK readers who had bought them. And that occasioned me going down to the local bookshop and ordering 400 copies of my own hardback for the princely sum of £3,600. So that was quite entertaining. Since then, and actually on Saturday, I loaded the car up with about 35 boxes of books and kind of very carefully drove the car home again. And they're all in the garage now waiting to be sent out. So that's going to be a little operation for next week. But yeah, we found out on the Tuesday, so just a week ago, that we'd made the list, which was the main objective. And we sold, I think, something like 1,750 copies, something like that. So five copies off number seven. Not that it matters. We just, you know, top 10 is, it doesn't matter if we were number two or number 10. We can now say Sunday Times top 10 bestseller, which is, that was the whole objective of the exercise. So, yeah, pretty pleased about that. It was touch and go because we weren't sure whether those sales would all count. And it turns out that they did. So, we're very pleased to have managed to hit that list. That was the goal.
Excellent. Well, that's really good news. Well done. Have you noticed a knock on with sales on Amazon of ebook?
No, not really. I mean, it's not especially. I've actually kind of taken my eyes off the KDP reports over the last 3 or 4 days, just because I've been so busy on other stuff, and there's not that much that I'm doing at the moment to kind of stimulate sales. I'm quite busy finishing another book off, so I've been doing that. So no, I haven't. I think I would have noticed if I had any kind of effect, and I haven't seen anything. On the other hand, in Australia, I had a Kindle promotion, one on Saturday. I think I've got one today as well, and that's occasioned those books leaping up into the top 10 in Australia. So it just goes to show that in terms of what sells books, it's not necessarily being on a bestseller chart. It's usually the promotional tools that you're able to deploy to best effect. And those Amazon ones are pretty powerful.
Yeah, that's excellent. Which reminds me, I've got a countdown deal on our books as well at the moment. I never look at rankings. I should look at rankings. We had a good first day, that's for sure. 1,200 today. We're on day four of that promotion.
Not bad.
Yeah, not bad. Number three in travel adventure fiction.
That doesn't sound like the most natural category for those books. It's like, was that one woodworking? What was that one?
Woodworking. That was the naked torso of a man holding a plane, not an aeroplane.
Yes.
Good. Well, that's really interesting. Well, I think we will have some more time later in the year to delve a bit deeper into the other things you do beyond KDP, which is starting to add up now for people to think about, particularly people in that bracket where you're in, a little bit ahead of where I am and others. Good. Okay, well, look, we've got a couple of interviews hopefully to record today for the next couple of weeks. It's the middle of summer. We're going to have a bit of a down week, I think, at SPF for next week. But we've got two excellent interviews, quite different in their own ways. Next week, to trail ahead, we are going to look at the statistical impact of COVID-19 on publishing and self-publishing in particular, on down to sort of granular category level, genre level, with Alex Newton. Very interesting interview that is coming up a week today, if you're reading, watching this on the day it's released. So I think that's the 24th of July. And we will have a webinar to go along with that, which we'll announce next week as well. Today's interview, however, is with a horror author who writes dark fiction. Do you read any dark fiction?
No, not really my thing.
But it is people's thing. It is some people's thing. And it's lots of people's thing. Yeah, so one of the jobs of my interview is to try and really work out what dark fiction is and how it differs perhaps from traditional horror and so on. Another crux of this interview, and really the learning that I hope you're going to take away from it, is about collaboration. So our interviewee, Daniel Wilcox, is part of the stable with Michael Andelay, writes into one of his universes, and has also recently started embarking on other collaborations and has written a book on how to get collaboration right. Now, we know that this is something that is spreading in the industry. We had the sisters on from Kent recently, the Peckhams, who write together, but it might be you and a mate combining forces to make this whole process a bit easier. So how to do it, how to get it right, how not to make the mistakes that others have made. That's one of the things you're going to learn from Daniel, as well as, of course, what exactly is dark fiction. Here's Dan.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Daniel, welcome to the Self-Publishing Show, the master of horror. Feels a bit like, for people in America who won't know this reference, like I'm interviewing Garth Marenghi. Was it Garth Marenghi? Was that his
name?
Yes.
Love a bit of Garth Marenghi.
Sort of dark comedy character a few years ago, didn't...
Yeah, that's very British humour.
Very British
humour. I don't know if that would translate to a US audience. It might do, but yeah, it's a fantastic show.
Quite a lot of British people won't have heard of him, but he was brilliant. You should look him up on YouTube. But yes, there you are.
Horror satire.
You're in your den with your horror books all around you. We're going to talk a bit about horror fiction and dark fiction and how easy it is to market it. I often hear people complaining that it's hard to sell, sort of once you get into horror, the audience is obviously not as big as romance. We'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about collaboration and opening up your streams of income. But why don't we start with a bit about you, Daniel? You're in the UK, not too far from me. What got you to where you are today?
So my journey started back in 2015, and I was working full-time in marketing for my previous job. I'd recently just had my first child, my only child, a son. And I was basically in the business of trying to find a way to, you know, when you first have a kid and you suddenly get very inspired to do all those things that you've never gotten around to doing. And I've never always had the dream of becoming a writer, but it was something I definitely took a lot of interest in because I'd worked in publishing previously for the local university, and it was something that just captured my interest. And after doing bits of editing on the side, decided that I wanted to start writing my own fiction. And it was at the end of 2015, after about 5 or 6 months of writing my first novella, Sins of Smoke, which I trialed out the publishing. I thought, you know, I'll give it a go, put it on Amazon, see what happens, because I'd just heard about KDP and everything else. And it did very well. It got to number one in the horror charts for short stories around Halloween of 2015. Did pretty well for me. And then from then on, the journey kind of continued. And, you know, I've been writing everything. I label myself under dark fiction because I've done some horror, I've done some dark sci-fi, I've done some post-apocalyptic. But I'm bringing that all around now back into horror, in which that's where I'm gunning my focus. So that's a bit of a whistle stop tour on my journey.
Sounds great. So just explain to me dark fiction as a genre title, a heading, I suppose. So that, sure. is there such thing as a dark fiction book, or are we talking about this being a general heading for other subgenres?
I'd argue it's pretty much an umbrella term for different genres. It's my way of saying I'm writing things that can link together. So if I've got an audience who's coming to me, they know they're going to get something dark, and it doesn't necessarily stick to a particular genre. But they know roughly what the broad themes are going to be. It's not going to be happy stuff. So like I say, within that, I've written in a couple of different genres and, you know, played around with different places where I might set up camp. And now I've swung back into the straight horror route, and that's where I'm going for. And it's something that, you know, I've been plugging away at for about 5 different years. I've spoken to your friend Tom Ashford on my show about having to try different things before you find where it is you really want to start pushing forward. And you know, I've been in a lot of different places and quite a few different genres, written with a few different people, and yeah, it's got me to a point in which, as of April last year, I was able to set up and make a more full-time living for my writing.
Wow. How many books deep were you at the point where you could sustain your income?
So I was about 9 or 10 novels, okay. A couple of different series and a couple of different genres, and also hit some success with, I've got a fiction podcast called The Other Stories, which I run with 4 other guys through a story studio called Hawk and Cleaver, in which we get, I think we're up to just over 5 million downloads now on that. And that's, wow, a way that we sort of bring people into our funnel and get them to read our fiction and to work with us on the horror stuff.
Wow. So your podcast, we'll talk a bit about that as being a funnel, because a lot of authors, because we run a podcast, yes, I often get asked, I want to start a podcast. And I do often talk to people and say, well, you know, what are your expectations from it? Because
it's hard.
It's hard. It's a slog, but it's got to be for a reason. Now, our podcast, yes, is very much for a reason. It's absolutely building our audience of authors and a community. Ultimately, that's how we operate. And you've found a way of doing that with readers, which actually is difficult, I think. You know, quite a few authors have set out to do that, to have a podcast to funnel in readers, and haven't, yes, been successful. But for you, it is working.
Yeah, we started the podcast in 2016. And it was just at the point where the initial core 4 of Hawk and Cleaver, which is Matt Butcher, Ben Errington, Luke Condor, and myself, we were basically trying to find ways to continually put out work while we were working on our bigger projects. So we decided to sit down and we each were going to write a 1,000-word short story within a theme and release that each month as an e-magazine. And then Luke Condor, who is our podcast guru, suggested turning it into a fiction podcast and getting voices in, putting it out each week. Which, you know, as someone who at the time was a bit of a verging into podcast arena, I didn't listen to podcasts, I really knew nothing about them. It sounded like a risk, and it was a risk that we took. And within 3 months, we'd made somehow 10,000 downloads.
Wow.
And it's continued just to plow on ever since.
And so just to circle back, because I probably missed it when you first mentioned, this is a fiction podcast. So these are, you're listening to what, audiobook style or dramatized versions of stories, or?
So we do it sort of audiobook style, but with sound effects. So I know, okay, you can get the dramatization, but we keep it very much, this is a short story, one person narrates it, and then we add the sound effects in post.
Okay, as opposed to you talking about horror books and the sort, yes, of more traditional non-fiction podcast.
Yeah.
Interesting. And do you promote the podcast?
Yeah, we promote it on, you know, iTunes stores and things. We got lucky enough to get pulled in by a service that has reps in sort of iTunes in America and different places, and they do a lot of advertising for us as well. And yeah, I mean, we probably could do more, arguably, but we're all quite busy guys. But yeah, actually, the podcast, it goes through peaks and troughs. It's continually growing, but it definitely accelerates around October, around Halloween time, which I'm guessing you can imagine
when all the
why that suddenly gets a lot of attention. Yeah.
What? Who writes the stories?
In the beginning, and actually for about 3 years, it was us four writers. And we, like I say, in the beginning, it was 1,000-word short stories. So it was quite fairly quick to write. And then the audience started asking for more. So we extended that to 2,000-word short stories. And then after about 3 years or so, we opened it up to guest submissions. So for the past, I want to say a year or so, I'm a bit vague on timelines with this. We got to a point where we get horror authors from all over the place submitting stories. And we change themes every month. So we'll have 4 episodes in a particular theme, like say witches, or it could be alien invasion or something like that. And yeah, people submit. And then now it's open to whoever wants to get involved and send them in. If people want to send them in, they can go to theotherstories.net and there's a submissions page there.
Okay. And who voices them? You voice them?
No, in the beginning, it was very, you know, bare
DIY
bones.
In the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, very bootstrapping. And Luke, one of our team, narrated a few. We actually already had connections with a couple of actors who were willing to do it for free. And over time, we managed to source more actors that just wanted to get involved. And we were very, very lucky that a lot of people were doing it for free. And most of the production was all done initially for free for the first few years. And we're now at a point where over the last year and a half or 2 years, we've been able to pay people for their work. So we get professional voice actors to jump in and do the readings and everything else. So it's a full operation behind the scenes.
Wow. You better give us the name again. So I think people will be off to something in Cleaver, was it? Hawk.
So the story studio is Hawk and Cleaver, Hawk, and the podcast is called The Other Stories.
The Other Stories. Excellent. Oh, it sounds like I'm going to give that a listen as well. And
yes, it's a lot of fun.
So you say more than 1,000 words now?
Yes, 2,000 words.
2,000 words.
2,000 word short stories, yeah.
But that's still, how long does that translate to in minutes?
It's around 20 minutes, 20 minutes an episode. Yeah, so it's good for a train ride, a drive to work or whatever. That's when we see our listens go up.
Maybe not when you're all alone on the train, on the last train home. Or is that the best time to listen to it?
No, I should probably add a bit of a trigger warning as well. Some of the stories can get quite graphic and touch some nerves, obviously. It's horror a lot of the time, so yeah, just fair warning.
Now, I am interested in this, in the story side of horror. I have to say, it's been a few years. I did, like, I think lots of teenage boys go through a James Herbert, Stephen King phase. And that's probably, you know, some of the novels that got me into novel reading very early on. But I probably went down the science fiction and broader fiction route since then. So I don't read a lot of horror today. But when I think back, I wonder, I'm trying to think of how the sort of tropes in horror, the actual story to the hero, because I think a lot about the hero's journey, obviously, as we all do. And do in horror films, do you lean towards there being a bleak kind of undertone to the story and a resolution that perhaps, you know, takes away your faith in humanity in exactly the opposite way of most of us are writing to try and have some sort of fulfilling message through there? Is that what horror does? Or do you still have the traditional hero's journey, just horror things happening around him or her?
Yeah, so it can appear on the surface differently. And I think people have this perception that horror is just misery through and through. I personally don't believe that it's a horror story unless it ends with some form of hope. Now, the form of hope that you end with maybe isn't along the same lines as your traditional other genres, but there's always that glimmer of something bright comes out. At least that's the type of horror that I write. I have read books in which basically everyone dies and that's just the end of it. But it depends what route you want to take, because as with every genre, you have your niches within the overall genre. My stories, they do tend to have a lot of, I'd argue, a lot of character growth as you go through it. Obviously, you need to have the traditional arcs of a story. Otherwise, it's not really a story. It doesn't compel readers to go through. But then at the same time, you have to be prepared for people to die at the end. And actually, I can't remember where I was speaking about this the other day, but I read a book recently, which was Christopher Golden's Ararat. And I will put a spoiler alert here. So anyone just pause this or skip ahead 10 seconds. But there's a point where you have these core group of characters and I'm reading it and rooting for them to survive. And there's, you know, four or five of them trudging down this mountain towards the end. And even I fell victim to the fact that only one of them lives. And I was there, I was going, oh, this person's going to live, they're going to be happy, they're going to, you know, end up together, all this kind of stuff. And it doesn't. And I don't know why I fell for that, because I'm a horror writer, read horror, who knows what the genre gives. But I think every story cloaks that trail that goes through it and then hits you with that surprise at the end. And it's a good story to actually manage to pull you from that emotional center forward that managed to drag you through to the end. And there was hope in that one character survived and lived on, but there's always that element of misery in there too.
Yeah. Hope is such a fundamental human thing that, you know, without hope, are you living type thing.
It's similar to when people watch a lot of splatter gore horror, which definitely isn't my kind of thing, because I'm not, I don't watch a lot of horror films because I enjoy people suffering. I like to watch a story and to see what kind of creatures and different things can pop out, because, you know, fear is as fundamental to humanity as hope, as love, as everything else. And one of the reasons I write horror is because I like embracing that fear and trying to confront it as opposed to shying away from it. And with splattergore, you get a lot of just killing for the sake of it, just, you know, blood, let's see how graphic we can make this. And that's just really not my cup of tea. I like a lot of psychological horror. I like a lot of creature horror, but I like there to be an intelligence in the way that it does drag you through to the end. And, you know, the prose is pretty, there's definitely a literary quality to a lot of horror. And that's definitely the angle that I sort of lean towards.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think back to, I mean, the Hollywood versions of horror films, which I know do often differ from the books, but they generally have a happy ending, even if I think The Exorcist and The Omen, at the end there's a resolution and things look better, even if there's that little hint at the end that things are not quite back to normal. But there you go.
That's Hollywood for you.
Yeah, so so that is interesting, glimpsing into other people's genres. And I'm always fascinated that you look at very, very, what you think might be polar opposite genres, like sweet romance, perhaps in this case, and and dark fiction. And yet there's these similarities really about the journey that somebody's is going on. It's really what's happening to them around them, and how they cope and change with
that. Yeah, it's a fundamentalist story. It's the same. You'll pick up any craft book and regardless of genre, they'll pull you through with whether it's a three act structure, whether it's sort of the individual character arcs and the tropes. Obviously the tropes change depending on genre, but there's definitely a unifying quality to any story, and then it's just how you manage to put the skin on the bones that makes it the genre.
Yeah. And then in terms of levels of gore and sex and violence in your books, do you have at the beginning, because I'm an ex-BBFC film examiner along with Mark and John, so we've thought a lot about this, and I know that the tone of a film is decided usually in advance in terms of what they're going to do at that level, and that sets how you feel about it as the audience. When they get it wrong, actually, I think it was Alien Prometheus where they got it wrong.
Did not enjoy that film.
Yes. No, it was wrong in so many ways. Don't get me started on the writing, but...
I did go to the midnight screening of that film and I fell asleep. So that tells you what it's about.
I don't blame you. But what was really interesting, because the film didn't work, for me it didn't work, and some people might argue with that, it didn't work on many levels. But I watched one of the behind the scenes on it at the BBFC, actually. And there they were filming, I think there was the sort of abortion scene by a machine. It was all pretty gory. They filmed it, they literally filmed it twice, once with white goo and once with blood and gore. And I'm thinking, if you're at the point of making this film and you don't know what tone it is, you don't know what film, you basically don't know what film you're making. And that's how that film came across in the end.
They didn't
know what film they were making. So is it the same with your books? Do you think this is for us? I'm not, because there's reader expectation going into a book. Do I temper myself with this series? And do I go, is this one going to offer more fan service of gore, that sort of thing?
So when I personally approach a story, I tend to just go for the stories that interest me. And I have a bend towards stories that, like I say, have the intelligence with the characters going on their growth and the misery that comes at the end. But in terms of gore and different things, I'm not opposed to, it takes a lot to bristle the hairs on the back of my neck, but I tend to move away from sexual horror and stick a lot more with the creature horror, the actual physicality of horror when it comes to, you know, people dying and whatnot. And I will add that I am a nice person, so I wouldn't...
Just checking that, yeah.
Yeah, because a lot of people worry about that, of horror authors. But no, I tend to... I establish what's going to go on very, very early. And in my latest book, which I'm currently working on at the minute, is I tend to like adding a prologue in which it sets a scene of what's to come. So there's that curiosity element of, okay, there's some element of supernatural, or there's some hint at the creature or the darkness that's going to come. And then when you step into that first initial chapter, it doesn't matter what you do with your characters then as you introduce them, the audience are already set up to know that at some point that's going to interlink and it's all going to come together. I have read a few horror books in which the first few chapters, like you say, they're a bit too happy and jolly, and they set the wrong tone for the entire book.
Yeah.
So it may be playing it safe in some ways, but for me, I really dive into writing that initial intrigue into that prologue. And that's definitely a thing that I love to write.
Well, that's great also for that sense of threat that keeps you going. That's why you know, one of the reasons you turn the page is you know something that they don't, which is great, being ahead as a reader. Okay, so how many series have you written? You've written 9 or 10 books, you say. Is that more than one series? Are they standalones? Or?
So I've got a couple of series, a standalone, a few novellas, and a couple in the works that aren't yet published. But my biggest series that I've got the Rot series, which I've written with Luke Condor, which is post-apocalyptic, and we've got 2 out of 3 books on that at the minute. Well, it's going to be 4 books. And I've written 5 books in a series within Michael Anderley's Catherine Gambit universe as well. So I've got that series, which, you know, does pretty well. And the one I'm writing at the minute is going to be a serial as opposed to a series. So I'm experimenting a bit more with serializing and putting out books that way and seeing if I can make that work for horror, because that seems to be something that is lost along the way somewhere.
Mm. So serials, if I get this right, they can be read as standalones, but they're set in the same universe. Is that right?
Not quite, no.
So series are the opposite.
They're more, if you think of them episodically, like a Netflix TV show. So they're shorter bits of work that come out and make that bigger whole. So the latest one I'm writing is When Winter Comes. And at the minute, I'm approximating it at about 6 episodes. It depends on which way I take the story. The first episode is 30,000 words. And then every episode after that is going to be 20,000 words. Wow. So that I can just rapid release and basically just keep putting content out there while I'm working other things as well. Because obviously we've seen a lot of people who... they make their success by being present and constantly putting out new stuff. So as long as I can keep hitting releases, I'm trying to, I wouldn't say game the system, it is kind of game the system, but creating shorter works that I can keep putting out while I also work on the other pieces around it too.
Yeah. Best marketing for your current book is your next book, as I think
exactly.
I think Michael Andelay once said. Yes. Okay, look, we'll come on to the collaboration in a moment. Just a bit about mm-hmm. marketing then. So what's your sort of marketing setup? Are you in KU for a start?
I'm in Tiling KU at the minute. Yeah. The only exception is my latest book, which is Collaboration for Authors. And even the ebook for that is KU. And then the paperback and hardback I've taken wide to experiment with. But I'm one of the ones who I've done pretty well with KU, so I'm not in a position in which I want to mess with it too much. That's it's worked for me up until this point, and I've been tempted on a few occasions to play and go wide, and I probably will with some works in the future, but at the minute I'm sticking with Kindle.
Yeah, and how do you promote? Do you run paid ads?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a mix. I have a couple of AMS ads that go out. A lot of what I do is I'll keep on loops of the promotional sites that throw out your books. We try and keep a bit of a push through the Other Stories podcast with different books. We don't flood them because we find that a lot of the audio audience doesn't quite translate to reading, but we put mentions on there. And then what I have been doing lately is, and I know you had these guys on recently from the Story Origin guys, and I've been using that service a lot lately, and that's pretty much doubled my mailing list, which is fantastic. So I've been putting a lot of giveaways together, a lot of newsletter swaps, and just basically just connecting with the author community. I end up setting up a horror writers group called the Horror Writers Collaborative, which is, it's not huge. It's got about 130, 140 people in it. But for horror and for horror authors, that's you know, a modest size. And we use that a lot to just talk to each other, to try and set up promotions and see how we can advertise and push things, particularly within horror. One unique arrow I think I've got to my bow is that I am experimenting a lot with Instagram at the minute. Okay. And I've managed to increase my followers. I've got, again, it's not huge, but it's about 3,000 followers on there. And I'm making a lot of connections within what they call the hashtag Bookstagram community. So there are a lot of horror readers with 20 to 50,000 followers.
Wow.
Who literally just promote other authors' books and share it to their fans. And obviously there's, you know, coin exchanged for particular services, but I'm basically just looking at that and looking at that as an option to see how that would work. And I can't let you know how that's going to go at the minute because I don't know until when Winter Comes out, but that's one avenue that I'm exploring.
Well, that sounds really interesting. Do let us know how that goes.
Yes,
I mean, if somebody's built up a good audience and they're a good sort of sincere voice, why would you not make some money?
It's kind of crazy because it's pictures of books.
Right.
And the comments go mad. You know, they post their review, they get thousands of views on there, and it's just that social media influencer marketing that everyone's kind of coming onto at the minute.
Although Instagram are catching on to people who don't declare that they've been paid for a tweet. It tends to be celebrities, I've noticed, who get pulled up on this. But a few celebrities have, I think it's the ASA in the UK, the Advertising Standards Authority, have actually reprimanded a couple of individuals who, you know, I'm not going to name them because I'll probably get the name wrong, but they've said, oh, I've used this wonderful shampoo this morning.
Yes.
And followers have worked
out. And
then
they claimed it.
Yeah, they haven't said I was, you know, paid to say that.
I mean, you'd hope that anyone could see through that anyway. It's quite obvious.
Well, I would have thought so, but there you go. Yeah. The ASA don't have anything else to do at the moment because no one's advertising in the industry. So, Okay. Well, look, that brings us on to collaboration. And you mentioned Michael Andelay. So we've talked to, because that's how we speak in Cambridgeshire now. We've talked to Michael several times on the podcast, and I think people might be familiar with the operation he runs. So he started out like you and anyone else writing books and series and started to build this universe where other people wrote into it. And that coincided with him publishing those books. And so he now has this small empire where he has an army of people. And you are one of the foot soldiers there who write into this universe. So just tell us how you got involved in it and what that process was like.
So it was really simple to get involved, actually. And it was basically a case of I used to host a podcast called The Story Studio with my writing buddy, Luke Condor. And we used to get guests on the show, used to interview them. And Michael Andelay was one of those guests back in, I think it was 2016. And after the interview, I saw what he was starting to do with Kafir and Gambit. And I literally just shot a message and said, you know, if you don't ask, the answer's always no. If you have anything that I could get involved in, then please let me know. And he replied and said, well, what genres are you most excited about? And I said, at the time I was working on post-apocalyptic, I'd written horror. So I said, that was what I enjoy. And to give him his credit, he turned away and said, well, I don't think that you'd enjoy what we're currently doing because they're not the genres that you'd be interested in. And I was like, okay, that's fine. You know, you put yourself out there, you expect to get a no, particularly from someone of Michael's caliber. And it was a few months later, just out of the blue, that he sent a message and said, okay, we've got something for you. And within his Catherine Gambit universe, they were basically looking at a horror era that connects two other universes. So they called myself in and a few other authors and just started writing in what became the Age of Madness. And like I said, I've got 5 books in that series. My character will be tied into some other stuff as well. But yeah, that was kind of how that began. And it was a really, really interesting learning experience because I'd done a lot of collaborations in my time. I started off basically writing 3 novels with Luke in which we were 50-50 partners involved in the project. I went on later that year to write within Jay Thorne's American Demon Hunters series. And that was a different experience because I was taking his characters, his active protagonists and everything else, and then pushing them along on a journey. And then with Michael's, it was a case of, here's a universe, here's your spot, you can play. And basically, as long as what your story fits within the realms of what the audience wants and what they expect, you can have free reign to make the story happen. So it was a really, really good experience. And you obviously learn a lot being around authors of that kind of nature. And I think one of the biggest lessons I've taken away from that is that you just take your ego out of your writing if you want to try and make it commercially in this business, because you can be a slave to art, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to make money. And in all honesty, I did, before I actually took on the role with him, there was that point of deliberating, oh, is this going to be the right fit for me? Do mm-hmm. I really want to, you know, because you're stepping into someone else's world. But I've not regretted it ever since. I think it was one of the best decisions that I made. And even to this day, me and Michael connect and talk about different things and you learn a lot. So it's useful.
And in terms of I'll come on to these sort of commercial decisions that you made going into that, but in terms of the writing, so you have a conversation. Let's just talk about Michael Anderley for a start. You have a conversation about the universe. Do you keep in touch with the other writers who are writing in that part of the universe so you know what they're doing? Do you have Zoom calls every now and again, or do you email each other? Or
yeah, so we just drop each other emails and basically just talk about what is it, because we tend to set different parts of the world. So there are going to be big differences, but at the same time, there's obviously going to be a unifying set of rules. So the rules are established quite early on. You know, there are people in place that make sure that everything stays on track. And then you write the story. If you have a question about something that might affect someone else, you just shoot them a message. And a lot of it is writing your own story, but there are those elements of crossing over and just making sure that it all fits together, because particularly with a universe that big, there has to be some kind of order to all the chaos.
Yeah. Fascinating. And then with Jay Thorne, somebody else who's been on our podcast before, people might remember him and Joe Penn getting
fantastic
on a train.
Guy.
Yeah.
And gal, yeah.
Yes, and going...
Very
and,
fantastic people.
And writing that novel. I think they did it again, but they went down to New Orleans the first year. But yes. With Jay's books, you're taking, as you say, this is not him saying to you, okay, here's a spin-off area of my universe. No. You've got his characters in your hands.
Yeah, that was a whole different kettle of fish. It was a case of... I think he had, I'm going to say and probably get it wrong, about 7 books in that series at the time. And I was actually, before he collaborated with Zach, Lindsay and Joe, I think that was, my contribution was the last one into that. And, you know, my secret weapon, whenever I'm working with authors who have set series in America, I always find a way to drag their characters to the UK because then I can kind of really get in on home turf and there are a couple of things that I can get away with a bit more. But that was a case of, I read the other books. I tried to familiarize myself as much as I could with the different characters and how they worked in the different stories. And yeah, it was only a short book. I think it was about 20,000 words, but it was probably the most challenging collaboration I've been involved with, because when you're writing a book, personally, there's always that element of, I want to put my own stamp on it. But when you're working with someone else's characters, they have their own quirks. They have their own mannerisms. They have their own patterns of speaking, of being around each other. So there was an element of really having to pay attention to how I was crafting the story, making sure that it worked organically for those people, and then also putting my spin on it. And I ended up taking his characters on a trip into the lost tunnels of the London Underground to the monsters that live there. So
excellent.
It was fun. It came around in the end, but it was the most challenging in terms of creating the end product. But again, I learned a lot along the way.
And did you read all the series before you started writing in it?
Yes, absolutely.
Wow.
Every single book. It was interesting because you have, I'm going to get the names, Jim Heskell, I think, wrote one of them. Zach Bohan has written one of them. You have all these, John Monk, that was another one that wrote one of them. You've got all these people that are putting their own spin onto the same set of characters. And, you know, I didn't absorb every single line, but I definitely went through and read the stories, made sure I understood what people were taking away from it, the certain unifying rules, again, of how that world existed. And yeah, it was just part of the research. It was just what I had to do to get into the mind, particularly that story. I don't think I could have, well, I know I couldn't have written it if I hadn't have read everything else.
Mm. And in terms of the actual story then that you wrote, how collaborative was that? Was that you saying to Jay, respecting the characters and where they were going to end up, this is my idea? Or did Jay say to you, a bit like James Patterson probably talks to his writers, here's basically what the story is?
So it was more a case of, here are the characters, here's what they are, and you can play with it a bit. So he wasn't very restrictive in terms of where I said it or what I wanted to do. I originally approached him and said, I'd love to bring these characters to the UK. Would that be a problem? And then, you know, you basically go through the throes of sending an outline, coming up with the idea, and pitching it backwards and forwards before you get into the trenches of actually writing the book. There's a lot of pre-work involved, okay, in which you get that nod of approval. It's not just a case of, here are the characters, just run. There's a lot of planning and making sure that the story's right before you even put your fingers to the keyboard.
Yeah. And of course, interesting connection here, because Jay Thorne's podcast partner in crime is J.D. Barker, who does indeed work, yes, with one of those famous authors.
Fantastic podcast as well.
Yeah, it is a great podcast. It really is. Mm. We're trying to get some of those guests that they've had on there, because they've been really good. rounds a little bit, yeah, on podcasts. I mean, to, yeah, be fair, yeah, I look at a lot of podcasts and they have all the guests on we've had on in the past, but occasionally I listen to other podcasts that, yeah, we'd like him.
Anyway, it's a very small pond.
It is a small pond, yeah. Yeah. Now, in terms of the commercial side of things, obviously you write your books, you upload to KU, you are keeping 70% of the sale price that comes down depending on how you priced it, and so on. When you go into a collaboration, how does that work? Where do you begin with that kind of negotiation, and what do you get out of it?
So it depends, obviously, on the type of collaboration. So when me and Luke got involved in writing The Rot and a standalone that we did called Lazarus, that was literally a case of, you know, 50-50. We both put in, we agreed from the beginning that it was going to be equal input. So that was fairly simple. I'm not sure how much I can go into with some of the other collaborations, but I think it basically depends on what you're contributing and how valuable you think that your input is. I've seen collaborations in which it can be anything from 70-30 to 80-20 to 90-10. It just depends on what you're inputting and what you expect. Yeah, I think that's the best rounded way to answer, really, without, you know, breaking into things I shouldn't talk about. But within my new book, Collaboration for Authors, I do talk a lot about the different types of collaboration, how you can wait and negotiate and come up with what would be a fair figure. Because obviously, if you're in a position in which potentially you're an author who has written a universe and you're offering that universe for someone to write in, I would imagine that people would offer the person who's writing and doing the bulk of the work a higher percentage rate of the person who maybe had that initial idea, because the actual brunt of the work is done by the person who's producing the work, and then you take a smaller percentage as someone who's almost like franchising that idea out. But yeah, it completely depends on the type of collaboration and how you choose to negotiate that.
I guess it also depends on the value of the brand that you're writing into. So if you're, yes, for instance, yeah, if James Patterson phoned you up and said, I'd like you to write a book with me, you know that that book is going to be a massive worldwide bestseller because of him, not because of you. And that's no disrespect, yep, to you or any other, yeah, or yeah, yeah, JD or anyone other writers. That must fall into place as well when you're sitting there thinking, even with Michael Andelay or someone, that there's a brand, there's a marketing machine that is going to generate cash for that.
Yeah.
I guess that does ultimately, quite rightly in a way, reduce your worth in that sense. It's quite a hard commercial way of looking at it, but
no, it's absolutely, like you say, a lot of it is knowing your value, a lot of it is knowing what you're going to get out of that collaboration. And yeah, I mean, I've been in collaborations in which there has been an element of, you know, the quote stepping stone, as well as a slightly reduced fee, but you take that knowing that it's going to step you forward on your journey, and it's just a little lily pad on the way across the pond.
Yeah,
I'm on ponds at the minute. I'm not sure why.
Good metaphor. That's some presumably there's going to be a hand coming out of the pond in a minute, because it's a horror.
Oh yeah, probably dragging metaphor. You down.
Yeah, Carrie-esque hand. Okay. Yes. Well, yeah, let's talk about your book then. So you've put a lot of this this experience you've had into a book. Mm. Who have you aimed this book on collaboration at?
So it's I basically wrote this book to try and be the most robust guide to collaboration possible, and I would argue that it's aimed at more so people who haven't collaborated before, but even people who have collaborated, it takes readers from the beginning, in which it explores the mindset of what you probably need to get involved in collaboration. So it talks about putting your ego aside. It talks about the value of being honest and making sure that you know what it is that you want out of a collaboration before you even approach a collaborator. It goes into talking about the different types of collaboration you can get involved in, through to who are you going to approach, how are you going to secure that yes, and the best ways to make sure that a collaboration starts off properly. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that when they're reaching out and saying to someone, I've got this idea for something I want to collaborate on, a lot of people don't think about the other person and what they've got going on in their life. So you might have an author who, you know, they've just started the wheels turning on a brand new series. They've planned 6 books. They've got a brand new baby. They're working full time. And they've got a friend approaching them saying, I've got this fantastic idea for a series. What do you think? And as much as they'd love to do it, the reality is you just don't have the time. So I think a lot of it is looking at the other person's perspective. But then I start to go a little bit into, once you've got that yes, how to negotiate a decent deal that works for both of you, which is very, very key. It has to work for both of you. Otherwise, a collaboration is going to fail. And then it goes into the actual process of particular systems you can use to market, plan, different financial options for when it comes to, you know, putting your book together and reaping the money. And it even includes a couple of a few case studies from people like Michael Anderley, from people like Nick Cole, Jay Thorne, Zach Bohannon. And at the end, it's got a essay from an author who shall remain anonymous, but it details his experience of when a collaboration went terribly wrong, so you can learn from it as well.
Right. That sounds good. So being empathetic to your partner to understand their worldview.
I think the key to collaborations, and I'll give this away for free even if you don't buy the book, in my opinion and from what I've seen, is so few people take the time to negotiate from the beginning what it is they want, and they're very eager to jump in and start the wheels turning on a project. But so much of the hassle can be taken out just by being honest of what it is you can and can't give, and making sure that you're just open and honest to those conversations, and that you're working with someone that you know is going to work in a way similar to you. If you can set up an agreement together and say, okay, this is where we're going forward, and both feel good about it, you've immediately maximized your chances of actually making sure the collaboration is a success. And even if it's not, and you find out, you know, a few weeks, months down the line that it's not, you gave it your best chance. And what you might have learned is that a collaboration isn't necessarily for you.
Mm. Well, this is interesting to me, actually, because running in the back of my mind is the fact that we now publish Robert Story's books at our little imprint.
Yes, I was listening to that the other day. Yeah.
Books, yeah. So we have notes for 2 following books. Robert sadly passed away last year, but he left 80 pages of very detailed notes of 2, possibly even 3 books that would follow. Wow. And we're just starting the process now of finding somebody to write them. So I need to read your book, don't I? And I think it's what's really interesting to me is we do things, you know, we live in a world of contracts and SPF, and we are unfortunately going down that route. We have to. But getting that right from the beginning of understanding what they are going to get out of it, what you're going to get out of it, as you say, otherwise it's going to fall apart and not work.
It's so key, and it can be difficult. And I was in a position a couple of months ago in which I was speaking to a fellow author about a potential project that we were going to work on. And within that conversation, ideas were pushed forward to me that just didn't agree with how I work or what I was looking at going forward. The ideas, I think, clashed a little bit. And in those conversations, it can be difficult to say to someone who's clearly excited about an idea, I'm sorry, but this doesn't fit what I'm looking for. But a lot of that's knowing what your direction is and what you're worth, and then also being able to negotiate and speak to someone. And we ended up coming up with an idea that we put out, I won't shame him by naming him, but we managed to create a product that works and is currently out there and being enjoyed by people. So
great. And on a small technical note, I use PD Abacus to divide up the royalties at the end of the month. Do you use something like that? So that's Published Drive. They have there's a few of these out there now, but I find that one's a really very clean way of doing it.
Yeah, that's the one I recommend as well. I also recommend Bundle Rabbit for certain products as well, depending if you're looking at anthologies and things too. So yeah, it's not, in terms of the software, a lot of them are personal recommendations in there. I don't go quite comprehensively into all the options because I wanted to speak from my own experiences, but Published Drive's Abacus is one of the big ones in there.
Yeah, I certainly find that very useful. Well, you better tell us where you can buy the book and all good retailers, I'm sure.
Yeah, so I'm not sure when this episode's airing, but the book comes out on June the 26th, and it's available at pretty much all major retailers in paperback and hardback. You can find it on Amazon, and it's also on my website, which is www.danielwilcox.com, which is WILLCOCKS.com.
And we will stick it in the show notes as well.
Beautiful.
Well, Daniel, it didn't get too dark, did it?
Not too dark. No, like I say, I'm quite a sprightly, happy guy, so it's difficult for me in person to come out in horror, but read my books and you might be surprised.
So, no, I have just read 3 short horror stories yesterday for somebody who's potentially going to collaborate with us on these Robert Story books, and each one of them ended with everyone dying. Each one.
Yes.
There was no light at the end of that particular tunnel.
Interesting. Mm. Like I say, it can go either way. I prefer the glimmer of hope.
it's all we've got left.
That's all we've got left, particularly in these days.
Yeah, absolutely. We need hope. Brilliant. Daniel, it's been really good fun talking to you. Thank you so much indeed for sparing your time. And I just wish you huge heaps of luck with that book and everything you're doing in the future.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a blast.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go. So dark fiction. I did reference Garth Marenghi at the beginning of that interview, which is a reference I think maybe you'll get. And a couple of others, but not many other people. Dan did get it.
Yes, no, I do get it. So, that's... I was probably not so much of a fan as you might have been, but I certainly know who it is.
Very obscure and his British
dark,
comedy.
Dark Places? Dark Marenghi's...
Garth Marenghi's...
Dark Marenghi's Garth Places, that's the one.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. You're thinking of Wayne's World. Good. Okay, well, look, that's down for today. Book on collaboration, you know where to go to get that. Next week, as I said, we're going to look at COVID-19. We're going to look at the impact it's had on the self-publishing world, down to the books that did well, the books that didn't do so well. From a statistical point of view, and that's with our friend in Switzerland, Alex Newton and Klytics, and there's going to be a webinar off the back of that, so we'll give out those details next Friday. But until then, Mark, unless you've got anything else you'd like to say?
No, we can mention my little run-in with the bookseller next week, because that's quite entertaining.
Yes, let's talk about that next week. Let's whet people's appetite. Okay, all that remains for me to say is that it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with The Self-Publishing Show.